So COVID-19 is playing havoc with his musical career, and that's a source of stress that's been suffered by plenty of other people at the moment. But our next guest on Sunday morning reckons that stress isn't always a bad thing. In fact, if we approach it in the right frame of mind, she says, it could be really good for us. Now, more than 20 million people have heard Kelly McGonigal say all that in an online TED talk, as well as in her book, The Upside of Stress. But how can we be appropriately prepped for stress if we never quite know how or when we'll be confronted with it?
Great question. I love that you're starting from the premise that it's actually not possible to avoid stress all of the time. So I define stress as what arises in your brain and in your body when something that you care about is at stake. So in that first moment when stress hits and you can't just escape it or avoid it, one of the best things you can do is ask yourself, who and what do you care about? What is at stake? Why is this a moment that matters? And we know that as soon as you start to focus on your values, your priorities, your goals, maybe the people that you care about, it already starts to make you feel both more confident about your ability to handle that stress and more focused on what you can actually do in that moment. So many people have heard the term fight or flight, and we often think that the body's response to stress is always toxic, it's always harmful. You know, maybe we've been told that stress turns us into the worst version of ourselves. And another thing that's really important to do in moments of stress is to recognize that actually stress can bring out the best in you as well. So it's not the case that when you're feeling stressed, your priority should be to fix your feelings and calm down. You know, this idea that stress is always harmful and you have to get unstressed first in order to engage with life. So one of the things that I mentioned in the TED Talk is this idea that you can actually embrace stress as energy that you can harness, that you don't need to feel perfectly calm or even perfectly confident, but that you can feel your racing heart and sense that your body is helping you rise to the challenge. And that also can make your stress response both healthier and more skillful.
But Kelly, surely, like you mentioned, fight or flight, and that's something we can't control. We're fighting biology, aren't we? If we're confronted by something that's stressful, we know it is because we're not stupid. We're thinking, oh, we have to persuade ourselves this is going to be good for us. That's fighting the biological response, isn't it?
Well, actually, so your biological response to stress goes far beyond fight or flight. So you also have a biological stress response called a challenge response, which is basically when your body gives you energy and focus, maybe a little adrenaline rush, to help you really perform well under pressure. That's also part of your biology. We also know that you can have a stress response that's based in the biology of social connection, that when you're stressed, you can release hormones and brain chemicals that actually encourage you to reach out and ask for help, that make it more possible to team up with others so that you don't have to deal with that stress alone. And we even know that built into the biology of your stress response is the capacity to learn from experience. So, you know, you might be thinking fight or flight because you can feel your heart pounding. But at the very same time, your brain is releasing chemicals that actually help your brain become more resilient as a result of going through something stressful. So, you know, you introduced this idea that you have to fight your biology. And again, that comes really from the misunderstanding of what the stress response is. We so often only pay attention to maybe that initial discomfort of feeling, you know, muscle tension or feeling anxious, but actually you can learn to lean into and trust your body and your brain's capacity to engage with stress in ways that are both healthy and skillful. So it's not so much about persuading yourself that stress is good for you, but it's about leaning into reality and asking yourself, okay, stress is here, it's present, I'm going to deal with this, and to start to think about what part of your stress repertoire you can call on in that moment. So it's not only fight, like be hostile or flee, escape, or, you know, freeze under pressure, but it's also rise to the challenge or reach out and ask for help or lean into your capacity to learn and grow and to think of it as a situation where you actually can become stronger as a result of going through it. And all of those things, by the way, actually enhance the biology of your stress response. It's not the case that as soon as you're feeling stressed, it's like, oh, adrenaline rush, cortisol in your bloodstream, that actually how you think about stress in the moment of stress can create a whole cascade of changes in your immune system, in your cardiovascular system, in your brain that actually make your stress response healthier. So it's, again, it's not so much about, you know, mindset isn't so much about trying to persuade yourself that something isn't stressful or to persuade yourself that the stressful circumstance is good, but it's about choosing what you want to focus your attention on in moments of stress so that you can have a stress response that actually really meets the moment.
I like that concept of the stress repertoire that we can call on when confronted with a familiar feeling of stress. I'd like to come back to that if I could. But people can easily go online and watch your TED Talk that something like more than 20 million people have already had a look at. But one of the things mentioned in that, you pointed to a study which I think showed that heavy stress could actually help shorten the lives or even kill as much as a third of people if they don't deal with it in the right way. It's a big claim, isn't it, to say that if you do train yourself to be more positive about it and see it as something you ought to embrace, that could ameliorate that. That's
yeah,
a heavy
so
conclusion
let's
to draw,
talk about
isn't it?
That study. So actually what that study was the first study that made me really rethink how I talked about stress. Because I thought when that study was published, I thought it was going to be another study saying stress kills. You know, we've all heard that message that stress will destroy your health and shorten your life. And I thought, oh, great, another study that says that. Let me pick this up and see what that's about.
Yeah, because which then gives people the added stress of thinking, now I need strategies
exactly.
to avoid it. Right.
So actually what that study found was something really different. They actually tracked something like 30,000 adults in the U.S. for almost a decade. And what they found was that actually how stressful your life was not really a good predictor of whether or not you were likely to be alive at the end of the decade. What they found was an interaction effect that people who had the most stressful lives at the beginning of the study, if they also strongly believed that their stress was harmful for their health, they had an increased risk of being dead at the end of the decade. But for people who had really stressful lives who did not strongly believe that their stress was harmful for their health, they were the most likely to be alive at the end of the study. So my takeaway from that study, of course, it's one study, but my takeaway was this idea we have that if your life is stressful, you're doomed, that is not accurate. And that even for some people, having a stressful life looks like a protective factor rather than a risk factor. So that's what got me started on the hunt for science that demonstrates what psychologists now call the stress mindset effect, which is the idea that you often don't get to choose how stressful your life is. It's not as easy as wishing stress away. So when you can't just avoid or reduce stress, are there things that you can do that actually decrease the harmful effects of stress and increase your capacity to thrive when life is stressful? And that's where the mindset comes in. And the mindset isn't stress is good or stress is bad or stress will kill me or stress won't kill me. The types of mindset that really seem to help people thrive under stress is first to trust your capacity to meet the challenges in your life, to believe that even if what you're going through is difficult and you aren't sure how you're going to get through it, to trust in your basic capacity to meet that moment, that you are adequate to what life is asking of you. And also the mindset of remembering that you don't have to do it alone, to understand that often we are stronger together, and that part of what stress is sometimes telling you is that this is a moment that requires you to call on your resources, to use your support network, to help others as well. And also the mindset that says stress is something that ultimately can be an opportunity to learn and grow, and that for every situation you find yourself in, there are ways that you can make meaning out of that situation or allow it to change you in ways that you value, even if you would never have chosen to go through that stress if you had a choice. So those are the mindsets that are really protective.
It's actually making me think of, well, the example, the situation I'm in here right now. So I wasn't actually expecting to do this broadcast this week because I'm not the regular host of the show. I'm just sort of filling in at short notice. So when I got the call to say, actually, can you step up? Can you be Jim Mora this week? I was in the middle of getting my own show ready. So honestly, when I get the call, I'm thinking, this is going to be difficult. I've suddenly got a whole extra pile of things to do, but recognizing, actually it's an opportunity to do something different. So maybe in a way I was embracing that stress. But then you're thinking, now, as I begin to realize that my week is changing, I'm thinking, my partner is actually away this weekend. So actually this is going to be kind of difficult because the kids are at home, so I'll have to be in the studio. So immediately my mind starts racing to the things that are going to make this a bit difficult, while at the same time knowing I can do this, I've done it before. But then thinking, now I've got to do a whole bunch of interviews like the one we're doing right now about topics I know nothing about up till a short time ago, and I don't want to make a fool of myself by revealing myself as ignorant and talking about these things with these experts. So all these things were going on as I suddenly come to terms with the fact that, like, I've got another job to do at short notice. So am I adequately embracing the stress there or doing the wrong thing?
Absolutely. And I love that you shared that because these are, you know, these are ordinary stressors that you're talking about. And if you were to analyze each one of them, you could really look at that as evidence that you have roles and relationships that matter to you. You know, so often we think that there's some version of our life out there that it has, you know, all the people in it we care about and all the work that we find meaningful and all the activities we find enjoyable. But there's some version of that life where we never have to experience stress. And if you remember, you know, I define stress as what arises when something that you care about is at stake. So one way to embrace stress is also to recognize that there's no version of your life right now or anywhere in any alternate reality where you get to have this interesting job and you get to have a relationship and a family and all the things that we care about without also experiencing stress. And in fact, this is another really surprising study that I came across that actually asked people all over the world, and I saw like 122 countries of all ages, about how much stress they experienced. And what they found is that actually the people in the world who are happiest don't report low levels of stress, that stress is often basically an indicator of how many opportunities you have in life to do things that are meaningful. And in many cases, the very same roles and relationships and goals that provide us opportunities for joy and love and learning and challenge, they also are really stressful. And so just holding that mindset, rather than sort of imagining that if only you were doing life right, or if only life were working out the way it should, that you would never experience stress, that can actually really help us navigate the fact that life is going to be stressful.
But when I said earlier, were we fighting our biology if, you know, suddenly confronted by stress, difficulty, that we have to try and then have a personal response to that, which is to embrace it. Maybe I should have said fighting psychology, because I'm sure all these things you're saying are true, that there is opportunity there. This is energy and adrenaline that you can use, an opportunity to do new things and prove some things to yourself, possibly. But it doesn't feel like joy right when you're hit with it. It still is
a psychology.
But you immediately you think, I don't want to have to deal with this personal thing, this bad news about my family, or this difficulty with my job that I can't avoid. The instinct psychologically is to want to shed it, to wish this wasn't happening, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is what we're really talking about now, is a kind of psychological maturity, because humans have this natural instinct to want to avoid discomfort, avoid pain. And it is completely 100% natural. Even for me, when I wake up in the morning, I don't think, gosh, I hope today is full of lots of meaningful stress. And when things become stressful or I get bad news, I'm human too. I don't want that. I don't want to feel anxious. I don't want to experience loss. I don't want uncertainty. And at the same time, you know, the mindset that I'm really talking about now is coming to terms with how stress is part of the human experience. And in that moment when it doesn't feel good, to recognize there's not another version of this moment where reality is different. So what am I choosing to bring to this moment that acknowledges? It's about making a pragmatic, very practical, strategic choice. This is what's happening. And I don't get to subtract reality from this moment, but I get to choose what I bring to it. And it's fascinating that even, you know, you mentioned stress might not feel joyful, but we know that as soon as you start to focus on maybe someone you care about in that stressful situation, that actually you can watch in people's brains activation of the reward system of the brain that makes you feel more hope, that makes you feel more courage. And so there are ways of choosing what you attend to when things are stressful that won't necessarily make the whole experience joyful, but that bring in these emotions of courage or your values or connection with others that actually enable you to have a more resilient response.
But if you are a confident person generally, or someone for whom things are going well and have been successful and not generally susceptible to anxiety and you're well supported, well then if you are confronted by the stress of an unexpected event, you probably don't need to psychologically train yourself to embrace the stress, as you put it. It's the people that aren't like that or already have a whole lot of back catalogue of stresses they're already dealing with that are going to find another one on top of that really difficult. And no measure of wishing they had a different attitude when suddenly confronted with another unexpected stress is actually going to help them deal with it, is it?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I find your resistance really interesting, only because I work with people who actually experience high levels of stress and really do struggle with things like anxiety or depression or even severe trauma. And what the research is clear and what my direct experience has shown is that, first of all, having had a lot of stress in your life sometimes actually makes you better at dealing with new stress than if you're someone who has sailed along in life without a lot of adversity or feeling pretty confident. So it may actually be the case that people who have coped with a lot of stress in the past actually have become really good at dealing with stress. And that's also a mindset that can be quite useful, to think about your past stress as a resource rather than something that maybe has only weakened you. But also, one of the things, it's really is a paradox. Most people expect that this idea that, you know, in moments of stress, you could choose to view your stress as energy that you can harness, or in moments of feeling isolated and alone in stress, that you could choose to interpret that sense of being alone in your stress as almost like hunger. It's a cue to reach out and connect with others, that there are ways of thinking about stress that can support you. They are most meaningful and most useful to people who have the most stress, or even people who have been diagnosed with something like an anxiety disorder. It actually is the case that these things work in the moment when you need them. So what I would encourage you to do is, you know, the next time that you're feeling stress, to actually try on if there was a mindset that you heard me say today that felt kind of unfamiliar to you, kind of interesting. That's actually the moment when it works. And when we're in conversation like this and you're not really feeling the stress, this stuff can seem very abstract and maybe not relevant. But in moments when you're feeling overwhelmed, or you're feeling anxious, or you're feeling kind of lost or alone, that's exactly the moment when your mindset matters. And if you believe that stress can have an effect on your body or your well-being, you already believe in the power of mindset, because stress is literally the sense that something that you care about is at stake. And so if you can feel your racing heart, you already know that your thoughts can affect your body and that your emotions can alter your response. So in a way, you already buy into it.
Indeed, I think so. And when you described it as the surge of energy, I think that is how I feel about it. I mean, there is the adrenaline, like, the heart racing, this is something I have to deal with, and your body responds to that. But it's energy is a different concept. And that's where I think I do agree with what you say there. Well, my own personal experience reflects it. When you're confronted with something like, now I have to step up, and you do call up, how did you put it? The repertoire of stress responses. So yeah, that is one that does definitely ring true for me.
Great.
Well, plenty more about all that in your book, The Upside of Stress. And I'm talking to the author of the book, Kelly McGonigal, but also Kelly, author of your most recent book, The Joy of Movement. This one all about exercise. So I guess overlapping an awful lot here with, well-being, how we deal with stress and take care of our health and so on. Now, I mean, we know exercise changes the brain, or we're dimly aware of it, even if we're not experts in it. We hear about dopamine, runner's high, all that stuff. And of course, just that intuitive thing that moving, being active is good for us, and that'll make our brain and our mind feel better too. But are there ways that exercise, you think, fundamentally changes our brains and our personalities?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, so let me just tell you what I think is the most interesting scientific discovery about how exercise affects your mind and your brain. So when you think about your muscles, right, your leg muscles, your arm muscles, your glutes, we think about them as being there to move our bodies around. But scientists now know that your muscles are essentially an endocrine organ that can manufacture and release all of these chemicals into your bloodstream that affect every system of your body. So your muscles are basically like a pharmacy, and they hold on to the good stuff, the molecules that boost immune function, that increase your heart health, that regulate blood sugar, and that affect your brain. They hold on to those molecules until you contract your muscles through some kind of repeated movement, walking or running or weightlifting or dancing or anything that we might call exercise. And so when you move your body, your muscles are basically pumping out into your bloodstream all of these molecules that are incredibly good for every aspect of your health. And some of them actually target the brain. So imagine you go for a walk, or you're lifting weights, and your muscles are pumping out these molecules that some scientists have actually called hope molecules, because they travel to your brain when you exercise. And in your brain, they act as sort of a quick antidepressant. So they boost motivation, they reduce feelings of stress and anxiety. And in the long term, the accumulation of those molecules in your brain actually start to change the structure of your brain to make you more resilient to stress, and to help people even recover from something like depression or grief or addiction. And so, like, you could think about every time you exercise, no matter what the activity is, whatever it is that you enjoy doing, that you're giving yourself an intravenous dose of hope And I think that this is, you know, goes so far beyond the runner's high is a wonderful thing. But I think we know that that's sort of ephemeral and fleeting, and you feel fabulous when you exercise, and that persists for a couple of hours. But the idea that every time you exercise, that you're actually beginning to change the structure of your brain to make you more resilient, and also to make your brain more sensitive to happiness and to joy, it's almost like a miracle. And what I love about that research is that it says whatever muscles you can use, whatever body you're in, that this is available to you. So you don't have to run. You can dance, you can do yoga, you can swim, you can ride a bike. And that's something that you can do every day that also makes you better at stress.
So Kelly, if at this point, maybe I'll rerun my kind of cranky contrarian argument from when we talked about earlier. So to say that where you have a person who's confident and well-adjusted and well-supported is going to do fine when put under stress. Perhaps when it comes to exercise, people who are already fit, healthy, and know that they can pound the pavements for 10Ks and get those physical benefits and emotional rewards, they'll be fine. But if you are an unfit person, a person who's afraid of going out, or someone who is depressed or unhappy, it's going to be much, much tougher. You're going to have to persuade yourself, convince yourself, cajole yourself that you ought to get out there and do that movement.
You do. You have to support yourself in doing it. But here's something that was really important to me. So when I was writing the book, I made sure that the examples I was using, whether it's studies or the communities that I went and visited, and the people whose stories I told, these are people who are dealing with severe mental health challenges, including depression and grief. These are people with severe physical disabilities. These are people living with Parkinson's disease and recovering from strokes, people like myself who live with chronic pain. What we know is it's almost like that paradox we talked about with stress, that stress mindset is actually most important when your life is really stressful and you can't control it, that actually movement has its most phenomenal ability to support you, support your emotional and physical well-being when you're also living with things that can feel like real obstacles to move. So one of the things I like to encourage people to think about is moving how you can, when you can, where you can, with the body that you have, because this isn't about having to go fast or far. We know that as little as 3 minutes of any sort of movement reliably boosts people's energy and mood. And it's always about really honoring the body that you're living in and finding a form of movement that works for you. And to trust that movement, when it's done with that mindset, rather than a sense that I have to go a certain number of miles or I have to push that, you know, this hard, that if you can encourage yourself to move in ways that are possible today, the body and the brain will reward you. And those are the people I'm most speaking to.
I agree. I think if there are people that could benefit from this, but a lot of talk about exercise, a lot of the images you see is all about either, you know, losing weight, these really heavy goals, or, you know, that you must do this to improve your health, your life expectancy and so on. But it doesn't need to be like that. It could just be day to day. It doesn't have to be burning calories, wiping out all the maybe the bad things you do to yourself because you live an unhealthy life or lack willpower or something else.
Yeah, definitely not that mindset. And, you know, one thing that I'll encourage people to do, we know that music enhances the psychological benefits of movement. And just listening to music is actually one of the easiest ways to boost your mood or to empower yourself. So if you can create a playlist of songs that make you want to move or that make you feel powerful, that have lyrics that you really like, just put on a song. It's going to be about 3 minutes, which is sufficient. You know, that's a great dose of movement. And then move in any way that you're able to or that feels inspiring.
You've actually said, I think, in the book that 3 minutes is enough to achieve a positive reset. But is it really? Because when I listen to a song, yeah, sure, it affects my mood if it's a song I really engage with, but it's very temporary. And indeed, the same for me with exercise. I like to ride a bike and that helps me mentally reset if I've been working or whatever. Quick blast on a bicycle totally changes my mood, but for a pretty short time. Are these benefits really anything other than immediate and short term?
They really are. So it's fascinating. A lot of the research shows you may only experience the peak glow that, you know, sometimes people feel like they can take on the world, or real euphoria after a workout or after dancing to a 3 minute song. But when you actually look carefully, so, you know, you survey and follow thousands of people and look at their activity, What you see is that on days when people exercise, they actually report more positive interactions with friends and family for the next 24 hours, that they make more progress on important goals for the next 24 hours, that their mood stays elevated for many hours after their exercise. So the endorphin rush, the endocannabinoid rush that you get from 3 minutes of movement or 30 minutes of movement, that may not last at the highest levels for hours and hours, but movement primes you to be a different version of yourself. And so when you have that next conversation with a family member, who you are is actually like, it's a different version of yourself. I really encourage people to pay attention to their direct experience. And rather than look for reasons to say, oh, I'm not sure if it's enough, why don't you try and find out? Every movement unlocks different aspects of our human potential.
Well, Kelly, it's fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for joining us today. Kelly McGonigal, so author of The Upside of Stress is the book, also The Joy of Movement, the more recent one about exercise and its benefits we were just discussing there. And as we mentioned earlier, more than 20 million odd people have seen the video of your TED talk, How to Make Stress Your Friend. So pretty easy to find that online if you search for it. Thanks again for joining us this Sunday, Kelly McGonigal.
Great. Thank you so much. Have a great day.